explorers. So I'm a bacterial geneticist, and I work at Princeton. And I started hanging around with a couple of physics types recently. And so when Mark and the organizers approached me to come here, I was sort of pleased to accept. But in thinking about what I would talk to you guys about, I think what I finally decided was I would just sort of try and describe for you how a bacterial geneticist thinks about biological problems and tries to approach them. So I hope this is what you guys had in mind. So the problem that has always fascinated me for a long, long time is how cells build themselves. So the organism that I study, E. coli, can build itself every 20 minutes under really optimum conditions. And the cell is a really marvelous place. And it's a complicated place. And the mechanisms, the molecular mechanisms that are responsible for that assembly are what fascinate me. So the problem of cellular assembly is really too big and too complicated to tackle, I think, at this point. So what we've done instead is to focus on a subset of this issue. And that subset is, how is it that our proteins, all of which are made in the cytoplasm, get targeted to various different cellular locations? How does this process occur? What accounts for the phenomenal fidelity and specificity? And that's sort of what I want to talk to you about today, this problem of protein targeting. So the organism that we study, E. coli, unlike its more primitive gram-positive cousins that Hope studies, has a more complicated cell envelope. And actually, the reason that it's called a gram-negative bacteria is because you cannot stain these bacteria with the reagent developed by Christian Gram. And the reason you can't stain these bacteria with that reagent is because they have an outer membrane. So the E. coli cell is rod-shaped. It's about 2 microns long, 1 micron wide. And I'm going to draw you a cross-section of the envelope. So the characteristic feature of all gram-negative bacteria is this outer membrane. The cytoplasm is here. This is represents the cytoplasmic membrane, or the inner membrane. And the cellular compartment that's delimited by these two membranes is called the periplasm. So within the periplasm of gram-negative bacteria is where the cell wall is. So the cell wall is the peptidoglycan, or it's sometimes called the murine layer. And it is the peptidoglycan, actually, that gives bacteria, all bacteria, their shape. And it protects them from exploding in dilute environments. So don't forget that the peptidoglycan lays here. It's here. But I don't really know very much about how the peptidoglycan affects problems of protein targeting, and so I'm going to choose to ignore it. But don't forget that it's there. Gram-positive bacteria basically don't have this outer membrane. So they don't really have a clearly defined periplasm. So the inner membrane of bacteria, the cytoplasmic membrane, is a typical biological membrane. That is to say, it's a phospholipid bilayer. And basically, because prokaryotic cells don't have any cellular compartments, they don't have mitochondria, they don't have an endoplasmic reticulum, all of the membrane-bound activities of intracellular organelles in eukaryotic cells are carried out by this membrane. So this membrane here functions as the mitochondrial membrane, it functions as the endoplasmic reticular membrane, and so forth and so on. The outer membrane is different. The outer membrane is a lipid bilayer, but it's not a phospholipid bilayer. The inner leaflet of the outer membrane is phospholipid, and the phospholipid composition of the inner leaflet is more or less the same as the phospholipid composition of the inner membrane. The outer layer, the outer leaflet of the outer membrane, is composed of a characteristic glycolipid called lipopolysaccharide. And this lipopolysaccharide covers this outer surface with a very, very hydrophilic surface. And this is because of this lipopolysaccharide covering, Gram-negative bacteria tend to be resistant to antibiotics, for example, or toxic chemicals. And they can live in environments where their more primitive counterparts can't even think about living, like the mammalian intestine. I mean, the mammalian intestine has things in it like bile salts, and most bacteria can't tolerate bile salts. Gram-negative bacteria can, however, because of this protective barrier. So proteins, there are a characteristic set of proteins found in all of these compartments: the cytoplasm, the inner membrane, the periplasm, and the outer membrane. And proteins get directed to these various different compartments, as I said, with very high fidelity. So inner membrane proteins look like what most people think all membrane proteins look like. That is to say, they have large stretches of hydrophobic amino acids that assume an alpha helical conformation in the membrane. And so many of these proteins can be drawn in cartoon form like this, where each one of these transmembrane segments is a set of, say, 18 hydrophobic amino acids. Inner membrane proteins, then, by their nature, are all very hydrophobic, and they're all very rich in alpha helical structure. That's not so for outer membrane proteins. Outer membrane proteins are completely different. So I'm simplifying, but generally speaking, I think you can say that there are three types of outer membrane proteins. The first type of outer membrane proteins are lipoproteins. So lipoproteins, as the name implies, have lipid covalently attached to the amino terminus. And it is this lipid that embeds the protein in the membrane. So I don't really view lipoproteins as integral membrane proteins. And consequently, I won't have much to say today about how those proteins are assembled, although I must say that there is a fair amount known about how those proteins are assembled. The major class of outer membrane proteins are really the beta barrel proteins. So the beta barrel proteins, if you looked at the sequence of a beta barrel outer membrane protein, it is not especially hydrophobic. And so what these beta barrel proteins are beta sheets that have been wrapped into a cylinder to make the beta barrel. And the beta barrel is embedded in the outer membrane. And because of its structure, many of these beta barrel proteins function as porin molecules. That is to say, they are really molecular sieves that allow small molecules to cross this permeability barrier by diffusion through the channel. What? Some are and some aren't. So if you look at a beta barrel protein from the top, it looking down from above, it looks like a donut. So this is the beta sheet that's been wrapped into a cylinder, and this is the channel or porin in the middle of the molecule. Many of these beta barrel proteins function as trimers, so there would be three of these that associate. And there are porins that really don't have any particular substrate specificity, and they really function as true molecular sieves. So the major outer membrane proteins, OMPF and OMPC, have a molecular weight cutoff around 700 Daltons. The protein that we study most extensively as a model protein is a beta barrel protein that's called LAMB. So this protein has that name, LAMB, because it serves as the receptor for the bacteriophage lambda. But that's really not why E. coli has this protein, despite what guys like John Little think. The function it performs for E. coli is that it's a part of the maltose transport system. And in particular, it is a beta barrel porin in the outer membrane that exhibits substrate specificity for maltose and maltose polymers. So maltose, the disaccharide, is small enough to get through the outer membrane via the general pores. But dextrins, like what you have in beer, are glucose polymers that are too large to fit through the general pore. And they have to go through this one in order for E. coli to catabolize them. So mutants that lack this protein altogether, or mutants that don't put this protein in the proper cellular location, are resistant to the virus, and they can't use maltodextrins as a carbon source. So one of the reasons that we picked this molecule to study in the first place is because of these phenotypes. So these phenotypes allow both a forward and a reverse selection, which is a very, very important genetic tool. You can select for loss of this protein from the outer membrane by selecting for resistance to the virus. You can select for its return to the outer membrane, reversion, if you will, by demanding that the cells grow on maltodextrins. And the availability of both a forward and a reverse selection is really, really an important genetic property. No. 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 You can get Lambie mutants that are resistant to the virus but still have a functional pore. Okay?
You just going back to the beginning, you mentioned that there's remarkable fidelity for targeting to the appropriate compartments. Does that mean that, can people actually measure mistargeting of, say, a cytoplasmic protein to the periplasm, or is it unmeasurable, basically?
Well, it's measurable, but there's a degree. All right.
So I was curious. So there are, you can't actually measure a level of mistargeting, say, to the periplasm.
No, you cannot.
Oh, you cannot. Okay. Below the detection limit.
It's below the detection limit.
What's the density of proteins on
the density of proteins in the outer membrane? The density of proteins in the outer membrane is very high. The average distance between them? I don't know that. But the density of protein in the outer membrane is even greater than the density of protein in the red blood cell membrane. So it's very, very protein rich. It has a density of about 1.25, if that's any help. So for a membrane, that's pretty heavy. Yeah?
Beta barrels incorporate into regular phospholipid bilayer?
In the cell, never.
But artificially, they...
Artificially, you can make them do that.
Structure the protein that will keep it out of...
No, artificially, you could put a beta barrel protein in a bilayer. I'll tell you. Yep.
How many different types of proteins?
In the outer membrane? All right. So the outer membrane is very, very protein rich. That is, the content of protein is very high. But the number of different species is relatively small. Okay? So I would say 90% of the outer membrane proteins are 5 molecules, 5 different proteins. All right? And the total number of outer membrane proteins is probably on the order of 1 to 200, total number of different ones. Okay? See, what was I talking to you guys? Oh, yeah. So the thing I want you to remember for this talk is that because this protein is part of the maltose transport system, its synthesis is induced by maltose. Okay, so if you add maltose, the amount of Lambie goes up 20-fold or so. All right? So there are lipoproteins, there are the beta barrel proteins, and these are really the major class of outer membrane proteins. And then in addition, the third kind of outer membrane protein are really surface organelles. And surface organelles are structures like pili. And I will have something to say about pili. Now, unfortunately, there are lots and lots of different kind of pili. But I'm only going to talk about the kind of pili that's actually assembled in the outer membrane. So these pili are polymers. And what they normally, as far as I know actually, the only function of pili is to mediate attachment of a bacteria to some surface, either an abiotic surface or some eukaryotic cell. So I will talk a little bit about pili.
So I thought there were also structures that are used to exchange, like the small circular DNA fragments.
That may be true, but I would bet you those are beta barrel proteins. So I F pili. Yes, there are F pili. Yes. So the F pili mediates attachment of two different E. coli cells. Okay? But the F pili is not a pilus that's assembled in the outer membrane. So it's not one of the ones I'm gonna talk about.
Dextrin.
Only in use by polymers. There's no feedback mechanism that in a very rich environment that dextrin create more of this.
No, it does.
Okay.
If maltose or dextrins are present in the environment, then the amount of this protein is its synthesis is induced 20-fold. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Even if dextrin, not just
maltose. Either one.
Okay.
Just one thing on this. Can the cell take in large molecules like proteins in the
DNA? Well, the answer is yes. But how that happens, I don't know. The periplasm contains two different set kinds of proteins, I would say. Number one, it contains proteins that are involved in small molecule transport. And these are the so-called periplasmic binding proteins. So for example, there is a periplasmic maltose binding protein that's also part of this transport system. It also contains a lot of degradative enzymes, DNases, RNases, phosphatases, proteases. And it might be somewhat comparable to a lysozyme. In a eukaryotic cell. But it definitely contains a set of proteins that you would not necessarily want running around here. All right. So we learned long ago, and I'm not going to tell you this story, there isn't time, but we learned a long time ago that proteins destined for this place, the periplasm, or proteins destined here, the beta barrel proteins for the outer membrane, are made initially in precursor form. And they have a typical signal sequence at the amino terminal end of the molecule. The signal sequence is the prototypical targeting sequence. It directs proteins to a machinery that's located in the inner membrane that is called the SEC machinery in bacteria. And these molecules are translocated across here and into the periplasm. So proteins with a signal sequence are going to go through the secretion machinery. This secretion machinery that's located in a membrane is a heterotrimeric complex of membrane proteins, very hydrophobic membrane proteins. In E. coli, these proteins are called SEC-Y, SEC-E, and SEC-G. Signal sequences and the secretion machinery located in the membrane here are conserved in all of biology. All organisms have these. And that's in part why Gunther Blobel won the Nobel Prize a few years back. Bacteria differ somewhat. So in mammalian cells, this SEC complex is located in the endoplasmic reticulum. Bacteria do differ a little bit from eukaryotic cells in that the energetics of the translocation reaction are different. Bacteria have an ATPase that's called SEC-A. And this ATPase drives the translocation reaction. And it does so in a really fascinating way. It grabs a hold of the precursor molecule, and then when it binds ATP, it jams it through the secretion machinery. And then when ATP is hydrolyzed, it backs off, grabs a hold, and re-jams with another ATP. So the proteins are being pushed through the secretion apparatus in an ATP-dependent fashion, 30 to 40 amino acids at a crack. So in terms of biological engines, I think that's a really fascinating engine. Eukaryotes don't do this. In eukaryotes, the equivalent of the periplasm is the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum. And ATP is also used to drive translocation in eukaryotes, but it's used in a different way. There is a protein located in the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum that's a typical heat shock protein of the HSP70 class. And this ATPase may pull molecules in. And also in eukaryotes, the ribosome binds to the translocation machinery, and translocation is co-translational. So the energy of translation can push. All right? No. Yes. In fact, in bacteria, there's a specific secretion-related chaperone that's called SEC-B that binds these molecules and prevents their folding. All right. So proteins go through here in an unfolded fashion. And so all proteins of the periplasm and the outer membrane have to fold outside of the cytoplasm. Okay. The other thing you have to remember is that as far as we know, there's no ATP out here. It's hard to imagine that ATP could exist out here with all the phosphatases. And so that also presents a problem. So you have to fold proteins and target them to this membrane in the absence of ATP. All right? So we believe that for periplasmic proteins, all you really need is a signal sequence. So the default location, the default cellular location of proteins with a signal sequence is the periplasm. Clearly, outer membrane proteins, something else has to happen. Once they're translocated through here, they must be targeted specifically to this membrane somehow. And that's one of the things that we're really, really interested in. So, yeah. I'll tell you, Ned. Hold on. I'll get to that.
And the other question is the SEC-B. How does it know which protein to attach to? Is it nucleate on the signal sequence?
I don't know the answer to that question. No. It can recognize proteins. If you chop this signal sequence off, it will still recognize them. And I don't understand that. It's knocked off. SEC-A knocks it off.
So it's never co-translational in
bacteria? I'm trying to avoid that, John. What I will argue with you is that for periplasmic proteins and outer membrane proteins, the ribosome never pushes. All right? Since this signal is located at the amino terminus, it is possible that secretion starts before translation is complete. So whether you want to call that co-translational or post-translational gets complicated. So if the problem that we were faced with, how do proteins get from here to there? So we're bacterial geneticists, and the way we approach all problems is the same way. What we want to try to do is to isolate a mutant that can't do what we're interested in, right? Once we have such a mutant, then we can find the gene that's affected by the mutation, and now we know we have a component of the machine that's involved in the process we're interested in. right? So the goal of the geneticist is to isolate a mutant that's defective in this process. So in particular, what we would love to have is a mutant that is specifically defective in the targeting of outer membrane proteins, right? It can target periplasmic proteins, but it can't target outer membrane proteins. So I can tell you that over the years, we've designed a number of really, really clever selections to try to identify those kinds of mutations, and none of them worked. And it's possible, I guess, that we're not as clever as we think we are. but I think there's another contributing factor to this that I'll come back to later on in the talk. So what we tried to do instead is to try to go to get at this these mutants indirectly. And so I don't know how to describe this to you except that sometimes what we like to do is create a problem for E. coli and then see what E. coli does to solve that problem, right? And so we've done that in several different ways here. So the story I'm going to tell you starts with three different graduate students, each one of which came up with a different way to try and challenge the E. coli, and they all wound up finding the same gene. So in some sense, this is a very wonderful thing. In some sense, from the graduate student's point of view, it wasn't quite so wonderful. But let me tell you what happened. So the first thing is, we know that when proteins with a signal sequence are directed to the translocation machinery, the signal sequence interacts with the translocation machinery like this. The signal sequence is flipped. So the amino terminal end of the signal sequence never actually leaves the cytoplasm during the translocation reaction. Okay? We know that for the following reason. If we mutate the signal sequence processing site, right? If we do this for a periplasmic protein, then we wind up with a protein that's tethered to the inner membrane by its uncleaved signal sequence. In every case that I know of, if you do this to a periplasmic protein, nothing happens. In fact, the protein still works, even though it's tethered to the inner membrane. And actually, primitive gram-positive organisms sometimes use this strategy so that proteins aren't lost in an aqueous environment. So Christine Cosma, when she was a student in my lab, figured, well, if we did this to an outer membrane protein, we would interfere with targeting, right? And that's true. If you do this for LAMB, you interfere with targeting. The protein is stuck here, and it can't get to the outer membrane. What? How do we prevent cleavage?
Yeah.
The enzyme that processes signal sequence is called signal peptidase. Okay, signal peptidase has a recognition sequence. If you mutate the amino acids of that recognition sequence, it'll just ignore it. That's how we did it.
Strongly hydrophobic sequence?
No. Signal sequences are tripartite structures. So they start with a methionine, of course. In prokaryotic systems, there's almost invariably, very early in the sequence, one or two residues of positive charge, lysine or arginine. These positive charges are what's thought to anchor the amino terminal end of the signal sequence in the cytoplasm. Following these positive charges, there's a run of hydrophobic amino acids, say 13, something like that. And then there's a processing site. And so this is hydrophobic. In the processing site, the consensus sequence is ALA X ALA. Okay? So what we did for this mutation, actually, here, is that we changed these two alanines to bulky amino acids. That's how we stopped processing. So you're right. Signal sequences are reminiscent of transmembrane domains. So the interesting thing was, though, that this, when we did this, we encountered an unexpected phenotype. And the other unexpected phenotype is death. So if you do this, if you make this mutation in LAMB and then induce synthesis of the mutant protein by adding maltose, they die. So from a geneticist point of view, death is wonderful. Because it provides a very, very powerful selection, right? So we've created a problem for E. coli. This is, in some sense at least, a problem in protein targeting. It is a big, serious problem for E. coli. They're going to die. Let's see if E. coli can fix that problem, right? So this is what we mean when we say we're going to look for suppressors. I don't know. I don't know.
But,
oh no, it's not death by starvation. They die. So this phenotype, if you will, this unexpected phenotype, is maltose sensitivity. All right? So if you don't induce synthesis of these proteins, they're fine. Only in the presence of the maltose do they die, and so we will look for mutants that don't die in the presence of maltose, right? So we've created this problem for E. coli, and we want to see how they fix it. All right. So this is a typical suppressor approach. Geneticists do this ad infinitum. First you get a mutation, then you get a suppressor, then you can get a suppressor of the suppressor, and then a suppressor of the suppressor of the suppressor. And almost everything that's been done in bacterial genetics was done that way. All right. Bill Snyder had a different idea. And so one of the most important genetic tools that was developed to study this process.
The enzyme which is mutated to cut the SSM which is under maltose.
No. This is LAMB. No, we mutated this site, right? We mutated these residues.
You mutated the SS table.
Yes. All right. Yeah.
So in general, I mean, if you overexpress something which is not functional anymore, is it usual that bacteria dies, or is it very rare?
It's not usual. Not only is this protein not functional, it's mistargeted, and I think that's what's important, right? The protein is now in the inner membrane, and it's not supposed to be there. But like Mark says, I don't know. I don't know. It stays in the cytoplasm. Yeah, it's fine. But I got to tell you that the mistargeted protein in that case is not terribly stable.
So the thing that is stable is the thing that gets stuck on the inner membrane.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Okay.
How do you know the situation is that, you know, could an MD form a core in the inner membrane?
It's possible.
That all kinds of things.
I doubt it. We have antibodies that recognize folded LAMB and antibodies that recognize unfolded LAMB. And I know that LAMB, when it's stuck here, is not folded properly. So I don't think that it's forming a pore in the inner membrane. But you're right, if it did, that would be lethal.
It could be jamming this
secretion. It is not jamming this secretion machinery. We can show that too. Good point, though. So the gene fusion tool that we use to look to study signal sequences in the SHEC machinery sort of works like this. So somebody asked me this. What happens if you fuse a signal sequence? Ned asked me. to something that isn't supposed to be targeted. And initially what we did was we took a part of the LAMB gene containing the signal sequence and we fused it to beta-galactosidase. So this is a gene fusion, right? It makes a hybrid protein. The amino terminal end of the hybrid protein has the LAMB signal sequence on it. The carboxy terminal end of the hybrid protein is functional beta-galactosidase. Okay? So when you do this, of course, then the secretion machinery thinks it's supposed to target this. And it tries. But beta-galactosidase is an anathema for the secretion machinery of E. coli. When you try to secrete this, the beta-galactosidase folds in the cytoplasm faster than it can be translocated, and it is literally like putting a cork in the hole. And when you do that, the poor constipated bacteria dies, right? Because it can't any longer secrete any periplasmic or outer membrane proteins. So in this case, there's a toxicity as well, right? We've created a different kind of problem for the bacteria. Now we've plugged the translocation reaction. But the phenotype of this strain here is exactly the same. It's maltose-sensitive, right? We only see this toxicity when we induce expression of the hybrid protein. So this guy is maltose-sensitive too. That guy is maltose-sensitive. This guy is maltose-sensitive, but for different reasons. So the reason that we know that folding is a problem here is if we introduce into the LAMB gene, into the LAC-Z gene, a mutation that interferes with folding. Okay? Now this doesn't happen. Jamming doesn't happen. And this protein gets targeted all the way through the inner membrane into the periplasm. But alas, beta-galactosidase isn't supposed to be in the periplasm. So the periplasm is an oxidizing environment. The cytoplasm is a reducing environment. Beta-galactosidase is meant to fold in a reducing environment. If you put it in the periplasm, it misfolds, it aggregates, and it gets cross-linked into superglue by disulfide bonds. Right? So you just create this enormous trash out here. And so periplasmic LAC-Z is just as toxic as jammed LAC-Z, but clearly for a different reason. So I don't know, Mark, why it is toxic. I just know that it is. So in this case, we've created another problem for E. coli. It's got a bunch of crap in the periplasm, and we're going to ask them to fix that problem too. So you want to fuse something at this end?
I want to take that pink thing and turn it around.
You want to take the pink thing and turn it around. So you want the signal sequences at the end. What? No.
You can't make it.
No, sure you can do it. And I think it would work. So if you put the signal sequence at the end, we would wind up with something like this. That's what you're saying. I don't know. I don't know.
So Tom, what's the story about exporting proteins that are supposed to fold in the periplasm?
That's all of them.
Well, there's some of them that are supposed to go into the membrane, right? But ones that are really
difficult. Membrane proteins like this, right? How these proteins get into the membrane is a whole nother story. I'll go there if you want me to, but
I was going more on target for that, I think. I was just asking, you know, you have a problem with black seed folding and not being exported. What if you wanted to export something which is supposed to fold in a periplasm?
No problem. Okay? Actually beta-galactosidase is rare. Okay? If you fuse the signal sequence to most cytoplasmic proteins, it'll just go to the periplasm. It'll still misfold, but it won't jam. All right? Part of this problem is because E. coli beta galactosidase is so big, I think.
If you mutate the oxidase recognition sequence so that they're stuck like lambdin and the pink construct?
With this guy.
Yeah, for example. Or some guy that actually folds.
I don't know what happens if you do this, but I would imagine this is still going to misfold and cause problems.
Right, but if you do it with some more benign...
If you do it with a periplasmic protein, there's no problem at all, right? The protein folds fine and it works fine. Okay? So the third strategy... the third strategy is a little bit different. So... You probably know that all cells have a heat shock response, right? And the idea here is that if you expose cells to stress, like heat, this causes protein denaturation. And the cells respond by upregulating two kinds of proteins, chaperone proteins. And chaperone proteins try to refold the damaged molecule, and proteases. And the proteases presumably degrade molecules that can't be refolded. So the cytoplasm of all cells contains heat shock proteins. So there's DNAK or GRO-E. These are cytoplasmic chaperones. And they contain proteases like LON or CLIP. So these are involved in protein folding. These are involved in protein degradation. They're all upregulated by stresses like heat. It turns out that the chaperones that are upregulated to combat misfolded proteins are also the proteins that are involved in normal protein folding under non-stress conditions. Okay? So it's obvious, right, that if these proteins can't do anything for proteins that misfold in the periplasm, it's in a different cellular compartment. So the idea would be that there would be similar molecules in the periplasm to do similar things. I'm pretty sure that's true. However, I want to point out to you that they cannot be true homologs, right? Because every single one of these proteins requires ATP, and there isn't any ATP here. So for misfolded proteins in the periplasm, E. coli had to come up with a way to deal with this problem that's independent of ATP. So at the time we started this, there was one such protein known. And this is a protein that's called DEG-P. So DEG-P is a periplasmic heat shock protease. Right? And it is known that if you damage cells with heat, for example, expression of this goes up. So what Paul Denise did was to create this kind of a fusion. He fused the LAG-Z reporter gene to the DEG-P promoter. Okay, so in this strain, if you heat shock this strain, the expression of beta-galactosidase goes up. And so what Paul did was to just look for mutations that turn beta-galactosidase up all the time. Right? So such mutations, you could imagine, would either be involved in the regulation of DEG-P, or they would by themselves create protein folding problems in the periplasm. For example, if you took away a major chaperone, presumably periplasmic proteins would misfold and cells would respond by upregulated expression of this. There is none. Okay. So I did this just as an example of how we go about trying to study these problems, right? So we create problems for the beta-galactosidase. In this case, this is a particular problem. This is a particular problem. We can look for suppressors by simply looking for resistance to maltose. In this case, we're using a LAG-Z reporter, and we're looking for mutations that increase its expression. Okay, so far? All right. Yeah. Who asked that? DEG-P is clearly involved in degrading misfolded proteins. It also, by itself, has a chaperone activity. So it can fold and degrade proteins. There's a lot known about it. Its crystal structure has been solved. It's one of these great big dodecameric proteasome-like things. Ah, because this is what we call a gene fusion or a translational fusion. This is what we call a transcriptional fusion. This is not a hybrid gene here. We've just simply placed a new promoter on the LACZ gene. Yeah, it is, but the signal is exporting this fragment of DEG-P.
The argument you were giving before is that LACZ is somehow holding the
cytoplasm. But this doesn't go to the periplasm. There is not a signal sequence attached to this LACZ gene.
Different construct, different story. No, I think the confusion is that you're using LACZ here just as a reporter of the transcription level of DEG-P.
No, I understand that, but what the argument before was that LACZ could not be exported because LACZ was holding in the cytoplasm. If it folded the cytoplasm there, why does it put in the cytoplasm here?
Here, the beta-galactosidase folds in the cytoplasm and is active. It's not exported. Yeah.
Does it get to the periplasm?
No.
It just remains there. Yeah.
All right. So, a major class of mutation that answered all three of these, of all three of those selections, identified a two-component regulatory system, like Jim talked about yesterday. So I'll draw it like this. This particular two-component system this protein is called CPXA. Right? This is the histidine kinase. The histidine kinase is a membrane protein with a periplasmic domain. The response regulator in this case has a conserved aspartate on the amino-terminal domain and a typical DNA binding domain at the C-terminus. The mutations that we isolated were not null mutations. They are dominant gain-of-function mutations. And what they do is they turn on this signal transduction pathway all the time. Okay? And so lo and behold, one of the genes that gets turned on is DEG-P itself. Okay? So, in this case, when we turn on this signal transduction pathway, we know that we're increasing expression of DEG-P. That's why it answered this selection. In this case, the elevated levels of DEG-P degrade this crap. That's why it's a suppressor. That makes sense. This one we still don't understand. We increase expression of the CPX pathway, and the toxicity of this is relieved. But the molecule is not moved. It's not folded. It's not moved. It's still there. It's just not toxic anymore. And I don't understand that. What? No. Right.
You said this was the only gate.
No.
Oh, okay.
No. No.
It can't fold, right? When it's stuck like that, it can't fold and it's electrified by DEG-P in the degrader?
No. It is not degraded.
Oh, it's not
possible. Right.
And is the toxicity still leaves if you knock out DEG-P?
No.
What does DEG-P do? Nucleating some other
misfolding? It could be nucleating it, or it could be that DEG-P is just sitting on this thing and sequestering it. I don't really know. It doesn't. It doesn't. So if you look at the structure of DEG-P, it's like these two disks, right? And each one of these proteins has a pass domain on, like this. And so the idea is that the flapping of the pass domains shove proteins in and out of the cavity. No.
Tom, how do you know it's Deg P that's been, that's the important target?
I know that Deg P is an important target because Deg P null mutations are epistatic to the suppressor.
Could you have just turn on Deg P with a, make it constitutive independent of all the other targets?
Yes. It is a suppressor. I'm going to get there, okay? So the idea is, I hope you can see this, that we identify a two-component regulatory system. The idea here is that members of this regulon are involved in protein folding and maybe protein targeting. Right?
What other members are there besides Deg P?
The array analysis with this hasn't been completed yet. It looks like there's upwards of 100, if you believe that kind of stuff. Yeah. I'm going to get to that, okay? So I gotta take a little detour here. So in the meantime, in Carol Gross's lab at UCSF, Carol did something that's similar to this. And that is to say, she overexpressed a beta barrel protein. So this is the stress that Carol caused. And what Carol found is that if you overexpress a beta barrel protein, expression of Deg P goes up also. Okay? But interestingly enough,
is that really a wild type beta barrel protein or?
She used two different ones. She used OMPF and a protein called OMPX, and I believe it would happen no matter which one you used. So the idea is if you overexpress a beta barrel protein, you're accumulating folding intermediates, and it's the folding intermediates that are turning on the stress response. So the signal transduction pathway that Carol found is called the sigma E signal transduction pathway. So you heard a little bit about alternate sigma factors yesterday, right? So this is an alternate sigma factor, and the E stands for extracytoplasmic. So this sigma factor is involved in directing the expression of extracytoplasmic proteins. The regulatory system works like this. Normally, under unstressed conditions, the sigma E is sequestered by a membrane-bound protein that's called regulator of sigma E number 1. There's a second player here called regulator of sigma E number 2. All right. So the idea is misfolded proteins here, this binds to the misfolded protein, this gets degraded, sigma E gets released, and genes can turn on. Okay? So we know all this now. But to go back to my story, I can talk all day, Mark. How long do you want me to talk? The first thing that we wanted to do, and this was several years ago, was to try and show that these two signal transduction systems respond to misfolded proteins. And the way we did this was we started a collaboration with one of Eduardo's colleagues at Washington University, Scott Hultgren. So Scott Hultgren is the authority about the assembly of pili in the outer membrane. And the pilus that he studies most extensively, which I think David will probably talk about how this pilus is regulated, is called the P pilus. So I thought for a long time that this was called the P pilus because it's found on E. coli that cause urinary tract infections. But that's not true. It stands for pyelonephritis. Anyway, all the what? Yes. And it starts with a P. So this, how these pili are assembled is known in great detail, at the atomic level, really. And to summarize very simply, all the subunits of the pilus are made initially with a signal sequence. All the subunits of the pilus get translocated through the SEC machinery. But once in the periplasm, these subunits are met by a dedicated chaperone molecule. And the dedicated chaperone molecule is called PAPD. And this thing binds the pilus subunits to prevent their misfolding and aggregation. And then it delivers them to an outer membrane component that's called an usher. And this one's called PAPC. So you have chaperones and ushers, right? This is an outer membrane beta barrel protein. The chaperone delivers the pilus subunits to the usher in rank order, and they are assembled from the base. Okay, so that means that this is the first guy added and that was the last guy added. Okay? What?
The difference
between subunits? Yeah. Not all the subunits are the same. I don't know. Are you going to talk about that? You should ask. He knows more about that than I do.
No, I think you know more now. I've been traveling back for years. I stay in regulation.
Okay. The thing that struck me about this was that in this case there's a dedicated chaperone, right? And we know that if we take away the chaperone, the subunits misfold and aggregate. And so if misfolded proteins trigger these signal transduction systems, then all we have to do is produce a subunit in the absence of the chaperone and these systems should turn on, right? And that's what we did and that's what happens. But it's kind of remarkable. So we've looked at a couple of different subunits. One of the subunits we've looked at is called PAPG. This is the subunit that's at the real tip. Okay, this is the so-called adhesin subunit. If misfolded PAPG activates this signal transduction pathway and this one, both, there's a tip fibrillum subunit that's called PAPE. Misfolded PAPE activates this signal transduction system and not that one. So these systems can recognize misfolded proteins, yes. And the other thing that's really interesting is they can tell the difference between misfolded proteins, which is really remarkable, right? It's like telling the difference between scrambled eggs and fried eggs. I don't know how it does that. But it's a fascinating problem. Yeah?
My question that sort of relates to that is, are all members of the CPX regulon, all the target genes, controlled by RNA polymerase that uses sigma E?
No. Will you give me just 1 minute? I'll get there. Directly.
Just on this point, can I ask, have you ever found examples of a protein which you have two different genes which misfold presumably in two different ways, so that one version activates, say, CPXA and the other? So you don't have an example of a protein which can misfold either or, but either activate one or the other, but it's the same basic protein, it's just misfolded in a different way.
No. No. Yeah. No. No.
Is it possible that you're just replying to different levels of misfolded proteins? Like small, one is more sensitive than the other?
I mean, we haven't looked at that very precisely, but we have looked, and the answer does not seem to be no.
But right? If that's true, there will be some reason why the blue crap is not recognized and upregulates the animal's response, right?
Yep. Yeah, or it's a race, right? The systems do respond, but they can't respond fast enough. The system has to be pre-induced in order to deal with it. Richard?
I think you're down
No, but I would argue that since you, when you overexpress a beta barrel protein, you turn on only this one. That is an example. Although
that is an argument that against it, it just differently.
Right. If you pre-induce this system, this is not toxic. Okay, that's how the suppressor was isolated. Okay. So, yeah. Not that I know of. Individually, not that I know of. So, what we want to do, of course, is look downstream and find out what's in these regulons, right? And a variety of techniques have been used to do that. The chip technology is farther along here. This is work that Carol has done in Satish Raina in Switzerland. This is going more slowly, but we know some important players. So these two signal transduction systems both respond to misfolded proteins. They operate in parallel, right? They can detect overlapping signals, but they can also detect unique signals. Together, these two signal transduction systems control three kinds of genes. There are genes like DEGP that are controlled by both. And another example of a gene that's controlled by both is a gene called SCIP. And there's some evidence, weak, but some, that this is a periplasmic chaperone. There are genes that are controlled only by the sigma E pathway. And I will mention one operon in particular. This operon that's controlled by sigma E contains a periplasmic chaperone that's called SIRA and a big outer membrane beta barrel protein called IMP. The CPX pathway controls both of these genes, and in addition it controls a subset of genes uniquely. An example here is the gene DSBA. The DSBA gene is the enzyme in the periplasm that catalyzes disulfide bond formation. Okay? So just based on this limited data set here, I think it's clear that these two signal transduction systems control the expression of bona fide protein folding factors, right? And proteases. Yeah. Sigma 70. This is sigma 70. This is sigma E, and this is sigma E. Yeah, Richard.
You said that IMP is a large beta barrel.
So yeah.
That can be because of large pore size, large SIP capacity.
I don't know that. What I believe, and maybe I'll even get to, is that this beta barrel, this protein here, is the usher, the outer membrane usher for beta barrel proteins. Okay? This is the outer membrane assembly site. That's what I think. And how big it is, or what's its oligomeric state, we don't know yet. Yeah? Now, the cells get sick so quick that you can't really see the induction. So the question is hard to address because the molecule is toxic. Okay? The same is true here. When you induce these things, the toxicity is bad for the cells. It's hard to know what's really going on. All right.
I want to go back to something. Is CPX activating the sigma E promoter then, or is it activating another sigma 70 promoter at KFP?
It's activating the sigma E promoter.
Right, that's my question. So it can act both on sigma 70?
I believe it, yes.
Cool.
We haven't really proven that, but I believe it can talk to two different kinds of polymerase. There are examples of that, right? All right. So let me just tell you two short stories and I'll quit. I think I can do this in 5 or 6 minutes. The first thing that comes to mind is, why do you have two different signal transduction systems that operating in parallel? And what we really think is going on at this point, the current hypothesis, is that this is the signal transduction pathway that's built to monitor the assembly of the beta barrel proteins. Okay? The best evidence we have for that is that if you overexpress a beta barrel protein, this is the system that turns on. Okay? The other evidence we have for that is that these genes. SIRA is a periplasmic chaperone, and it has been shown that SIRA plays a role in the assembly of our friend LAMB. If you take away SIRA, LAMB assembly is not as efficient as it is in wild type, because there's probably a lot of periplasmic chaperones, right? So this is this concept of functional redundancy. And I think functional redundancy is part of the reason why our initial attempts to isolate mutants that couldn't target outer membrane proteins failed. Taking away just one of these proteins doesn't really cause that much of a defect. So functional redundancy to a geneticist can be addressed using this technique of synthetic lethality. All right. So if we take away SIRA, the cells are okay. If we take away SCIP, the cells are okay. But if we take away both, you're dead. So this, when you have a mutation in two different genes, either one of which alone is okay, but is lethal in combination, that's called synthetic lethality. Right? And synthetic lethality usually means redundant function. So I believe, based on genetic evidence, that these two proteins are both periplasmic chaperones, and they can functionally substitute one for the other. Okay? If we take away this protein, IMP, the cell is dead, period. So this is an essential outer membrane protein. And I can tell you that outer membrane proteins, there are very, very, very few outer membrane proteins that are essential for life. And the only ones I know about are, there's only two. This one, and a protein that's involved in lipoprotein targeting. So, I think this is involved in biogenesis. Yes, Jim?
So, is IMP also transcribed by another sigma E at some low level?
No.
All the time?
No. But sigma E mutants are dead also.
What?
Sigma E mutants are dead. It's on at some level all the time. Yes?
Is it one
of the five main? No. It's present at very low levels. 100 copies per cell. All of the sigma E mutants that are alive are carrying unlinked suppressors. No. Good question, but no. Eduardo? Are you sure they don't have an unlinked suppressor? It could be. It could be. There's more than one essential gene in E. coli that's controlled by sigma E. So the other thing that we've done that's really interesting is that if we mutate IMP and then ask what happens to newly synthesized proteins, the newly synthesized proteins don't get to the outer membrane. They're building up somewhere. That's encouraging, but I don't yet know where they're building up. But I think that all outer membrane components are assembled following the paradigm of the P-pilus. I believe that there are periplasmic chaperones that deliver the components to an outer membrane assembly site like an usher. I think that's how the process works. And this is one of the periplasmic chaperones for beta baroproteins, and I think that that's the usher. That's what we're trying to prove. The CPX system, on the other hand, I don't believe its primary function is to monitor beta baroproteins. I believe what the CPX system does is to monitor the assembly of surface organelles. Right? So, indeed, the simple act of expressing the P-pilus turns on the CPX system in E. coli, and this is an essential assembly factor for the P-pilus. If we kill the CPX system and try to make a P-pilus, we can still make a P-pilus. But if you look at cells that are making the P-pilus, they look like hairy beasts, right? If you kill the CPX system in that strain, it looks like somebody gave the hairy beast a haircut. So it's still making pili, it's still making the same number of pili, near as we can tell, but all the pili that are being made are short. And that, I think, is consistent with an assembly defect. So I think the primary function of this is to monitor surface organelles. But clearly there is some functional overlap. Yeah? Okay.
Even if it is what it does in E. coli, there must be some other intrinsic property that may be more widespread and more true to the really core of a city of that, that it's going to be conserved across other organisms that don't have a culture.
I mean, it's possible, but the P-pilus is an example of one of many pili that are assembled in the outer membrane. It's not specific to the P-pilus. You understand that, right? So you want to say that the CPX system has some function other than pili, or in addition to? Like what? No. That may be how the system monitors pilus assembly. Yes, I agree with you. And this is another one of these examples of a two-component system where we don't understand what the signal is, right? I mean, to say misfolded proteins is not terribly informative. I think it's about 100 angstroms. But the size of the periplasm is... That question is unbelievably controversial. Why? Various people get... The estimates of how big the periplasm is range from 5% of cell volume to 25% of cell volume. It might. I don't know.
Yeah,
What is certainly clear, what is certainly clear is that there's an outer membrane protein called TALC, okay? And TALC is part of an efflux pump. And the TALC structure has been solved. Its crystal has been solved. So this part of the TALC molecule is a beta barrel that makes a hole. And then this part of the molecule is a collection of alpha helices that extends all the way across the periplasm to the inner membrane, probably. And these efflux pumps sit here and dump molecules into this channel tunnel, right? So these molecules can exit all the way across the E. coli envelope, right, without ever seeing the periplasm. Okay, so this is clear. Whether this is what the microscopists call an inner membrane, outer membrane contact site, that's not clear. Okay?
What's the distinction between
inner and outer membrane? So if you'll take this protein as a measure of the periplasm, it's about 100 angstroms. Or 140, I forget. Something of that. I think I'm out of time.
Okay.
But what?
No, you're not.
I mean, I can talk about that. We also believe that this protein is a touch sensor. Do you want to hear that story too? All right. So I'll try to make this quick. So as we thought that all along that the CPX system is involved in monitoring pilus assembly. And as far as I know, the only thing pili do is attach, okay? So the idea was maybe this is involved somehow in sensing attachment. And so initially we started off adding E. coli to eukaryotic cells to see if we could get this system to turn on. But that is just a mess. Because when you add bacteria to eukaryotic cells, there's all kinds of stuff going on, right? It's warfare. And the bacteria is trying to kill the eukaryotic cell, and the eukaryotic cell is trying to kill the bacteria, and I don't know what anything means, really. So there's a postdoc in my lab who developed a simpler system. So the simpler system is that she just takes glass beads. And these glass beads are about 500 microns in diameter. And she treats these glass beads so that the surface is hydrophobic, and that's important. Then what she does is she puts a whole bunch of these glass beads in a tube, right? Obviously, the idea here is to increase the surface area. And then you can add bacteria to the beads and ask what happens. So if you add bacteria to the beads that are hydrophobic, the CPX system turns on. It really does. So there's one other thing that I need to tell you. So another technique that geneticists use to look for suppressors is a technique that's called multi-copy suppression. So the idea here is you take a plasmid that contains a random collection of chromosomal fragments. You transform that plasmid into your strain. And since the plasmids are present at 50 copies per cell, any gene that's on the plasmid will overexpress its product, most likely. So you can look for genes that, when overexpressed, confer some phenotype. And so when we did this, we found you could suppress this or this by overexpressing an outer membrane protein that was a lipoprotein. This is one of these lipoproteins that's called new lipoprotein number 5. So if you if you overexpress new lipoprotein number 5, you turn on the CPX system. And if you turn on the CPX system, you suppress this toxicity, right? But we could not figure out what new lipoprotein number 5 did. We mutate new lipoprotein number 5 and nothing happens. The CPX system still works fine. But in this assay, in this adhesion assay, if you mutate new lipoprotein number 5, the CPX system does not turn on. So we believe that adhesion to certain kinds of surfaces sends a signal through NLPE to CPX. Misfolded pilla subunits, misfolded proteins, send a signal to CPX in a way that does not require NLPE. And I think that NLPE then is somehow involved in monitoring what's happening at the surface. But I don't know how that works. And I believe that at least some of the genes that are regulated by the CPX system are involved in adapting to life on the surface. So in addition to protein folding factors, there are these other kinds of genes that I think may be important too. And I mean, it's possible that the real function of CPX actually is more along the lines of life on a surface. Maybe that's what you're driving at, Eduardo. Or maybe you have another idea.
One thing that I'd like to, for the sake of simplicity, I'd like to believe that there is a common factor, a common thing that is promoted both by adhesion by NLP and by misfolded proteins. I'd like to know if there is such an elusive factor. There are not different ways that, you know, formally it is possible that there would be, you know, a million different signals converging on a particular system. I like to think that things are simple, that all the signals, what they are doing is creating, either upregulating something, that, you know, doing one unique thing, which is what is being sensed actually by the system.
Yeah. The only thing that I can tell you is that to sense the adhesion signal, you have to have NLPE. To sense misfolded proteins, you don't need it.
But do you know that NLP interacts directly with CPX?
No.
So it could be quite...
Direct interaction is an anathema to the geneticist, right? There is always possible somebody else you don't know about.
Did you check it? Could it be that NLP mediates a pathway that upregulates some surface organelle on adhesion? And that's why CPX is turning on.
Yes, it's possible, but I would argue, given how fast the response occurs, that that's not likely.
So, how busy is it in the parent class? If you start getting misfolded proteins, is that likely to disrupt structurally? Could it cause like panic stress if you have misfolded proteins?
Yeah, it's very busy in the periplasm. I mean, if you induce the maltose system, the maltose periplasmic binding protein is present in the periplasm at concentrations higher than millimolar. And that's just one protein. It's been referred to as a gel. I don't know if I believe that, but it is very protein rich. Nothing. It's plenty big enough to do something. It's 150 amino acids or so, but we can't get any hints from the sequence about what it does. Yeah, there is a CPXP. I don't know. The answer to your question is I don't know. What Eduardo's talking about is that a lot of these systems, like this is a negative acting periplasmic factor. There's a negative acting periplasmic factor for the CPX system too. So it's possible that this is the guy that identifies misfolded proteins, for example. We don't know that yet. Yeah. No. In this glass bead assay, where the surface is hydrophobic, pili are not involved. Okay? So what I would really like to, I don't know what this correlates to in biology, but I'm pretty sure that E. coli doesn't see hydrophobic glass beads very often. But I don't know what it's reflecting. I believe it's reflecting something that E. coli does, but I don't know what it is. Yeah.
Is it known how, you never told us the name of the response regulator, is it CPXE?
Oh, I'm sorry, the response regulator is called CPXR. It's dephosphorylated by this kinase.
Oh, really? So that being inactive.
Yeah. I would argue that most of these two component kinases are also phosphatases. And if you're going to ask me, are they phosphatases the way REC-A is a protease? I don't know.
Are any of the periplasmic chaperones or periplasmic proteases
not that we know of. What usually happens is that if you mutate one of these guys, you upregulate one or both pathways. Probably because there's more damage now than there was before.
Could it be that they sense the damage and directly interact with the sensors, and as you increase damage, you decrease the available pool?
Yes, provided you stipulate that there's redundancy. Yeah, but I don't think it can be. I don't think there's that you can say, well, Skip is that guy for CPX. That's not true. Okay, there could be specificity, but there still has to be redundancy at both, or we haven't found the right chaperone yet. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think that's an interesting unanswered question, right? What is diffusion in the periplasm? How good is it? And to make matters worse, remember, there's this chicken wire mesh of peptidoglycan in here, right? That's separating the outer membrane from the inner membrane physically. So not only do you have to get through the periplasm, you have to get through the peptidoglycan. And I didn't draw that up here because I can't explain it. Which proteins? No, I don't think so. But I don't know.
I don't think a lot is known about what's localized and what's going on in the peptidoglycan.
No. And this protein here, this tall C protein, for example, this clearly must extend through the peptidoglycan. And how that happens, I don't know. Okay, thank you.